Hello and welcome to The Sober Experience, formerly known as The Spiritual Experience, where we share stories of overcoming problematic situations in life through triumph and working together, as well as recovery topics and all other forms of spirituality, self-help, and the like. I'm your host, Jay Lewis, and here we go. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to The Sober Experience. Don't forget to subscribe and share on all podcast platforms, including our new YouTube page. We could always use the support, and we appreciate all the feedback that we've been getting. And today, we have a wonderful guest who I have been, wishy-washy, wanting, been nervous about asking him to come on because he's always been such a such an inspiration for me. As far as like somebody's, recovery that I've admired for a long time from a distance and, as we've gotten closer to be friends. So, but he's here to, we're honored to have him. I don't want to go crazy with all the flowers, but everybody say hello to my good friend, Joe. Joe, say hello.
Hello.
All right.
Joe.
Beautiful. Joe, first things first, where are you from?
I'm from relatively rare these days. I am a native of Brooklyn.
Beautiful. Where did you grow up? What neighborhood?
Oh, in Windsor Terrace. Yeah. Well,
nice. Did you you have brothers and sisters? What was it like?
I had two older sisters, 9 and 10 years older than me. And when I was younger, I could never figure out why God visited older sisters on you.
So were you like a surprise baby, or your parents just took a 10-year break?
Those are questions that I never asked, but it'd be hard to, it's hard not to believe I was a surprise.
Right. What kind of a kid were you? Did you play sports? Were you good at school?
I was okay in school. I mean, I did well. I was never good at sports, never particularly interested in them,
Right. What were your main hobbies? What did you like to do?
I watched television. Believe it or not, I remember when my father brought the first television into the house when nobody had televisions. I remember going to the kid's house whose family had a TV,
What did you think then when your dad finally showed up with one?
Wow, it was amazing. I sat down and stared. Stared. That's what you did. Stared. Everybody was in the living room. It was a little screen, and you had to. At the time, you wow, I haven't thought about this in years. You had to make the antennas, set up the antennas. They were on top of the TV.
Like manually, you had to go and...
Right, yeah, you would have to do that before they got antennas on the roof and things like that.
Wow.
So,
was it like cohesive?
Cohesive?
Meaning that, like, okay, we're all going to sit down and watch TV together?
Oh, well, it was cohesive, but I have a very firm memory of I wanted to watch Wyatt Earp, and my sister wanted to watch Eddie Fisher. And I got to watch Wyatt Earp, and my sister poured a bottle of Pepsi over my head as I was sitting on the floor watching Wyatt Earp. So I don't have too many memories of arguing, but that's an unforgettable memory. That was That was it.
What kind of work did your dad do?
He was a manager of a warehouse. He worked for Sterno Incorporated.
Also in Brooklyn?
Also in Brooklyn, down in what was called Bush Terminal and is now called Industry City.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. When I drive through there, they have like those trolley tracks.
Right.
That was, those cobblestone in between the buildings. Like, I guess there was that was like a huge place down there.
I remember as a kid, every single building was full of people and businesses, and
it was bustling.
Yeah, and the trolley tracks were being used.
Wow.
Yeah, that was part of the whole deal about Bush Terminal. They'd bring stuff in over the water, and they'd move it in there.
Yeah,
it was all of that level of industry has left Brooklyn,
right?
That I know of.
Yeah, this I understand. Over there now, it's like fancy town.
Yes, so I gather. I haven't been there in a while.
There's sushi bars, ABC carpet, and like all this other stuff. And I mean, there's a few manufacturing things that are there, but they're not like making things. I mean,
no.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. The whole world has changed.
Actually, Sterno Incorporated, Sterno was the famous thing for chafing dishes. Do people even know what Sterno is anymore? I don't know.
The only thing I know about Sterno is those flame things that you put underneath. Is that what they are?
That's what they were. They were what made chafing dishes and all sorts of hotel equipment.
Wow.
Function.
Yeah. And it's funny because my mom would say, don't forget the Sternos.
Right.
Yeah, that's funny. Okay, so then as you're growing up, did you come from a family of drinkers, or what was the story then? What was the atmosphere?
I never saw my father finish a drink.
Wow.
Never once. They'd pour him a cocktail, and he'd sip half of it. But I had a lot of uncles and aunts who finished a lot of drinks.
Yeah.
So it was around me, but I never saw my father finish a drink. I never saw my mother take a drink. So
what happened with you when you started? Like, how old were you?
Well, that's one of the interesting things to me.
Sure.
I have no idea. Everybody seemed to be drinking when we were 15, 16, 17, 18. At parties, and my memory is that everybody seemed to be drinking a lot. I'm not at all sure that's an accurate memory. What happened, I don't really, to this day, understand. Everybody who was drinking a lot seemed to not give it up, but let it go, And by the time they were mid-20s, 25, 26, they let it go. And my friend Dougie and I didn't stop. We didn't let it go. And I truly don't understand it. I mean, what I would say, and I still say, is I loved to drink.
Yeah.
I loved it.
From the beginning.
Yeah, that's my memory, Among the things that I am sure of, I am absolutely sure that if I picked up a drink today, I would be drinking alcoholically.
Oh, yeah. For me, it fits like a glove.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It may be like, even if it's like the left-handed glove on the right hand, I'll get it on there. Don't you worry.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt that I would be drinking alcoholically if I picked up a drink.
Yeah. When you started, were you drinking alcoholically right away, or was there progression? What was that like?
I think there was a progression, you know.
He said it started out at parties,
right,
here and there.
And I can remember one of the very firm memories that I have is I had two little boys. My oldest son was handicapped.
Right.
And I'm sitting...
When were they born?
Oh, let's see. Well... The oldest boy would be 40. He's passed away.
Yeah.
He'd be 45 now, I think.
Right.
Yeah. 45 or 46, and my youngest is 40 now.
Right.
And I remember sitting in my chair. My wife was out. And I was drinking downstairs. They were asleep. And I remember thinking, if something happens, I'm not going to be able to get up out of this chair.
That was like a cognitive thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a big bridge between, oh, we're 16, 17, 18, drinking at parties, right, to now you're an adult. How old were you when you think you had that thought?
Let's see. Well, I must have been like 39, something like that. I came into AA when I was 40.
Right, so between 18 and 40,
right,
it was just every day?
No, it took some time to get to every day. It took some time to every day.
You were progressing in life, though. I mean, obviously, you started a career, you had a wife, had some kids.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's the idea of the down-and-out alcoholic, you know, is not the alcoholics I hung out with.
Right.
So, yeah. No, that's, you can go a long time before you can't keep drinking. You can go a long, long time.
Right. Yeah. What was your relationship like with your wife when that was going on?
Well, my memory now, because the memory is different than the reality at the time, but my memory now is she and the kids would go up to bed. What I remember now, it seemed to be earlier and earlier, you know. And that's... The other memory I have with my wife is I went to my first meeting. I used to go to work hungover.
What kind of work did you do?
I was a manager I was a manager of a pretty large office.
Right.
And I would...
would go to work managing a large office hungover?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I can remember, there's so many wonderful memories of, like, getting on the subway and thinking, I'm going to throw up on this guy in front of me. You know, which, you know, I think when I look back, I think the insanity of the second step is for real.
Yeah.
Any normal person would go, in fact, one of... I've never forgotten. I worked with a woman who was had the same job I had, and she was one of these people who never finished a drink, you know. And I asked her because one of the things I did as an active alcoholic was I never ever talked to anybody about my drinking.
Right.
never talked to. I was not a bar drinker where everybody was BSing each other and things like that.
Did anybody ever ask you or talk to you about your drinking? Like,
that's part of the story too. Actually, I was like, I mentioned I was from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And people won't believe this, but Brooklyn in the 70s was going down the toilet. It was over. Everybody was moving to Long Island, and New Jersey, or something like that. Brooklyn was going down the toilet, literally.
I heard there was like a bar in every corner. People would say that, like...
Oh, there was. I mean, and I lived in a very nice neighborhood then, but there was a bar on every corner.
Right. Right.
Every, if you know Brooklyn, 7th Avenue.
Right.
There was a bar on every corner from Flatbush Avenue to Prospect Avenue.
That's over, that's about 20 blocks.
Yeah, yeah.
Including all the name streets.
Right.
Yeah.
And every... I mean, that's...
And it's walkable for those of you who don't live in New York.
Right.
You can stumble from one block to the next in a couple of minutes.
Right. And every block had their own bar. Wow. I mean, the bar at the end of the block was the bar where if you didn't go there first, it was where you ended up.
Right.
If that makes any sense to any.
That's funny.
Are there any non-alcoholics listening to this? Because would that make any sense to them? I don't know.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So did people start asking you, say, hey, Joe, what are you doing with yourself?
Again, memory was a friend. They're still friends of my, the husband of one of my wife's best friends asked her if she wanted him to talk to me about my drinking when I was like 25, 26, something like that.
Right.
And she told me, and I said to her, we had all gone out. I was talking about people leaving Brooklyn. We had all gone out one day to the first couple that bought a house in New Jersey, which is, I still don't understand why anybody goes to New Jersey, but that's all other thing. And, you know, I have a way with words, and I said, no, that's not necessary. The only reason I was drinking a lot was because it was hot out.
Right.
That was it. And,
how old were you when the kids were born?
Let's see. So I was 30. I was 40 when my second son was born, so I was like 34, 35, somewhere when my first son was born. So.
We're doing the math,
right?
10 years before kids show up, somebody's asking somebody else to ask somebody else to talk to you about your drinking.
Right.
This is 10 years before you end up in the basement.
Right.
15 years before you end up in the basement, right? With them going upstairs, and it's already a problem in your mid-20s.
Oh, yeah, when I look back, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. In fact, when I go out and I'm at some relative's house and I'm looking around, I can see. I mean, alcoholics don't even hold a glass the same way as a normal person does. You can pick out the alcoholics easily, you know. They're holding a glass like somebody's going to take it away from them, you know. I'm not kidding.
I recognize my alcoholic face in other people when I see it. Uh-huh. And I'm like, oh, that guy, he's not having a good time.
Right.
You know? And I can look at somebody if we're in a gathering, and I can be like, this guy's wife is busting his balls about his drinking.
Right.
Because you can see he's like drinking at whatever.
I've seen that.
Yeah, and it's on our face, and then, right. But my face can feel his face. It sounds very crazy, but I can look at him and be like, oh, he has potential. We'll save him a seat. He has potential. So you're in your mid-20s. This is going on. There's a big flight from Brooklyn. You are staying put.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Buying
the house we're in was the best idea I ever let my wife talk me into.
Did she work at the time or no?
Oh, yeah. We both worked all the time.
Right.
We both worked all the time.
Yeah, so you're young people. Right. You buy a house. She's already asking her friends to talk to you about your drinking. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, some years go by. And it's the same old roller coaster.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I will tell newcomers in AA is if you walked in the door, you're an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Nobody comes to AA in a whim. You know? I mean, nobody comes to AA by mistake.
Right, yeah, it's not
an accident. I've never met anybody who, I've met a lot of people who don't stay. But that doesn't mean, you know, I guess they're out there. I haven't met everybody, obviously, but.
I think they're also out there doing 12-step work. They're in the bar telling people they should go back to AA because their life is miserable.
You think so?
Yeah, I mean, one of the conversations I have with people, not all the time, but periodically, when somebody will say things like, oh, you know, back in the day, AA, we 50, 75, 80% of people would come in and they'd get sober, and now we're at like half of a third of a percent or whatever kind of BS that they're saying, right?
Right.
And my defiant reply is that the reality is that people back in the day really had to be desperate to go to a meeting. You know? I mean, no internet, no cell phones, no this, no that, right? And even before then, in the 50s and the 40s, and the like, you know, they're mailing each other books in the mail, so whatever. But the program has evolved so much so that I think part of it works like too good. Where in you come in, and if you go to a meeting a day and try not to drink, in 90 days, you're going to forget that you was a drunk. You know, you cleaned up a couple of bills. Your significant other maybe is not so mad at you anymore. Your boss is off your back. You maybe ate a couple of meals with nutrients and, you know, not liquid lunch every day. And then you'll forget that you can't never drink safely ever. And then you'll go run back out. I've seen that happen more often than people thinking the program doesn't work. I've seen people come in and do everything they're supposed to do. And then I'm like, oh, no, you forgot that first part of the first step. You know, and then next thing you know, they're back out there, and then they're like, "What?" Yeah, they find out how patient the disease is. It's not just whatever cunning, baffling, insidious, all those sloganese kind of words, but the disease is very, very patient.
Right.
Very, it's just gonna sit like dormant. Just hanging out, you don't get rid of it. And then in the right environment, it's like a fungus. Poof, here we are.
Right.
Yeah, remember me? You know, so you were still drinking. You said your oldest son was handicapped. He was the first one born.
Right.
So what afflictions did he have? Don't mind me asking.
He was severely handicapped. It was the result of a very difficult birth.
Right.
And maybe he could function as a 5-year-old, and he had trouble walking. And
how did that affect you?
Ooh. I think about him every day of my life.
Yeah. Especially then, you were still drinking when he was born.
Right.
And that's not something you can just put in a drawer somewhere.
No. I honestly believe that if it wasn't for my wife and children, I had a real shot at drinking myself to death. That was
sincerely.
Sincerely, yeah. I've never forgotten walking down the block I live on, and there was a guy sitting in an areaway. Do you know most of the people in the country don't know what an areaway is? You know.
Explain to the listeners.
It's. It's usually a concrete, it's in front of your house, between the sidewalk and your house. There's a concrete part where you could go out and put a chair out there, and the entrance to the basement is usually
right there,
off the areaway. So the guy's sitting in the areaway, and he's sitting in this ratty old beach chair. And it was the summertime, and he was in Bermuda shorts, and there were running sores down his leg.
And his sores, like S-O-R-E, sores.
Sores, right.
Wow.
And he's got a 40-ouncer in his hand. And I thought to myself, I remember it because it was so vivid. And that's part of the thing about sobriety and AA is you get the message where you get the message. There's lots of messages.
Sure.
And I remember thinking, that could have been me. You know, that could have been me.
Was he older than you?
At the time I saw him, probably, but, you know, one of the things about drinking and smoking dope and stuff like that is it really ages you.
Yeah, well, no, it's
really.
Because sometimes, really the reason why I ask is, like, you see a guy like that, and be like, oh, he's pickled.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, I'm 34.
Right, exactly.
And you're like, Jesus, sir.
Right.
Yeah, but that, you know, that stays in your mind.
Yeah, I've never forgotten that guy. You know, that I know it rankles some people, but there but for the grace of God, you know, go
sure.
on.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you have this one boy, and then a couple of years later you have another kid.
Right. Who's a wonderful, he's a wonderful man.
What was that like in between each child? Were you, like, scared to have another kid? Were you having those kind of conversations? Was your wife like, hey, you better get your drinking under control because we have this person with this young child with special needs?
No. I don't think I was. I guess I was working my way up to it, and I was sneaky. That's another fond memory of alcoholism. You can't make this stuff up. I remember that, not just me, but lots of people used to carry an attaché case to work.
Right.
And I switched from a soft-sided attaché case to a hard-sided attaché case, a leather one to a... And the reason I did that is because in the hard-sided attaché case, my wife couldn't see the bulge of the fifth of the Gordon's gin bottle when I was coming into the house, because that, you know, Gordon's gin bottle, for those of you who aren't a gin drinker, is square.
Yeah.
You know? And it fit nicely in an attaché case.
Yeah.
That was hard-sided. I could get it into the house. So, like,
were you drinking around the clock at that time?
Well, I was drinking. No, I mean, I didn't. Well, I never drank around the clock like a real alcoholic. You know?
Right.
I was never. I drank a lot all the time. I drank a lot all the time. I've run into people who ended up alcoholics who never drank, you know, anywhere near as much as I drank.
Right, but I mean,
they,
you're...
They were the real deal. You know?
Yeah, you're changing your briefcase so you can hide your booze.
Right, right.
Yeah, looking back, it's like, you know, for me... I drank so much Gordon's one day that I never drank again that Gordon's gin. And
that was my drug of choice.
Listen, my parents, as they became more affluent, then the Bombay came to the house, wow. Right? The blue bottle. Mm-hmm. But I already had the bout with Gordon's that I even... Did I give you water?
No, you didn't.
Oh,
no.
Hold on, guys. Let me grab the waters.
Yeah, I thought I gave you the... Yeah, they're over here. Sorry about that. So you
cough. All right, we're back. So, point is that I had such a bout with Gordon's that I couldn't... On the left... side of my house where I grew up, we had these pine trees. And if I stood too close to the pine trees, I would smell that pine, and it would remind me of the Gordons, and I would want to puke. You know? So Gordons I know pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it looks like you're on your way. You know, this other kid comes along. How does that change things for you?
Well... I mean, that's a really good question. All I can think of is, you know, I knew I had to stop. I knew I had to stop. I knew I couldn't keep going on. And this sounds very severe, and I got to the point where I hated myself when I woke up in the morning, knowing that my two boys were, you know, were upstairs, and I was drinking downstairs, like I said, and yeah. I remember opening my eyes and cursing the day. And that's never happened since I came into AA. I've had the worst day of my life in AA, but I've never cursed the day, if that makes any sense to people. Yeah.
So how did you go from being downstairs, separated emotionally, mentally, whatever, from your family, to getting into recovery? What happened?
I think, you know, it wasn't any... I think it was, you know, waking up, cursing the day, hating myself, and realizing that somewhere along the line, I don't know how to describe it, realizing that this can't go on, you know. In that sense, it's a gift.
Sure.
It's a gift. That was a gift, you know. And
how'd you get to your first meetings?
Well, one of the things I haven't mentioned is that I had an Uncle John who was a real old Irish drunk.
And compared to you?
right. And he was, he got into AA and he talked about it all the time with my mother when he was over. And I remember thinking.
Is this like your mom's brother or your dad's brother?
My mom's brother.
Right.
And I never saw my father or his brother take a drink.
Right.
So something was going on. And I have absolutely, by the same token, both my parents were Irish, and I never heard one happy story about Ireland. Not one, not ever.
That's funny.
Yeah. And so where were we? We were at...
How did you get into AA?
So,
was there like an incident or something? You said, all right, that's it, I'm over. And, or was it just gradual and you're like, one day, hey, look, I have to go to a meeting?
I'm not sure. There was a pileup of being hungover, going into work, hungover. One of the things I remember learning how to tie your tie when I was working, everybody was wearing a suit and tie, and I could tie my tie without looking at myself in the mirror, things like that. There was no big incident, just working just reminded me of... I never ever recommend anybody talk about being an alcoholic on the job. Now, if you need to go to rehab and they'll get you to a rehab, then you might have to talk about it.
Right.
But I don't recommend it unless...
you're ready to get some help.
Yeah, unless you're ready to get some help. The reason I say that is I went to my boss and I had lied to him on a regular basis. That was part of
the job description.
Right. I had lied to him. There was a period when I was the only one doing the job that I was doing, and he'd ask me if this had been done. I tell him this has been done, and it hadn't been done, and while I was drinking, and I went to make amends, and I told him, you know, I'm sorry that I said, I'm sorry that when you were asking me whether such and such had been done, I had told you it was done and it wasn't. I'm sorry, I was such a pain in the ass. I don't think I used those words. And he said, well, thank you for talking to me about this, because I didn't know what was wrong with you. I thought you were crazy. I thought you were crazy. And the reason I bring that up is they don't know what's wrong with us. They think we're crazy. Why is he lying to me? Why, you know, it's like normal people don't know what it's like to be addicted to alcohol, you know, or addicted to anything else. I am so old that you actually knew the junkies in the neighborhood, you know, when I was growing up. Now, I always tell people the world changed when the guys came back from Vietnam. It's another world now. You know, it's another world now. I don't think there's anybody in AA who hasn't used, you know, or it seems that way to me. But that's AA has changed, and
For the better.
For the better, you know. Everybody's, I think it's a much broader and open, you know.
So when you start going to meetings and you start putting some time together,
right,
what kind of impact did it have directly, like, on your life?
Well, I got...
First of all, what year did you get sober?
1984. I got well cared for, and I tell people I know how AA works. It works by the love of one alcoholic for another alcoholic. That's how AA works, you know. I walked in, that uncle who was the alcoholic was in the meeting. I walked in and he said, what are you doing here, Joe? And I said, I think I got a drinking problem. And he said, oh, you're in the right place. I've never been pushed around in AA. I've never been told what to do. That's why I remember that. That was all he said. Oh, you're in the right place. And when I'm talking to a newcomer, I tell him, you know, if anybody starts pointing their finger at you and this is what you got to do, this is how you got to do it, this is how we work the 12 steps, just walk away. Just walk away. That's, you know, maybe it works for some people, but it wouldn't have worked for me. You know that's, mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're an odd bunch.
No, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I always make the joke that as a people, there's nobody more offended by help than us.
Oh, that's true.
Right away. You want to help me? Fuck no. Meanwhile, life is burning. I'm like, no, I'm okay.
It wasn't that long ago I was at a meeting. There was a new guy there. He said he was new, and I walked over to give him my phone number. And you could see it's like, what's this old guy walking over to me for? You know, why is he giving me his phone number? It's like, okay, okay, you know. But, yeah, the, yeah. It still works for me, by the way, you know. Taking calls from newcomers still works for me. I am, it proves to me it hasn't gotten any better out there.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think my experience also is it doesn't happen a lot for me, but it does happen where we'll bring a new guy to the diner and we're going to buy the new guy a burger. And then at the end, he goes on the speech saying, "No, you guys, thank you so much. I promise next time I'm going to pay all of you," right, and blah, 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 and this whole thing. Because mm-hmm. then we're like, listen, we're just going to buy you a burger. Nobody owes anybody anything. Right. One day you'll do it for somebody else. Oh, yeah, you want to take a pee break? We'll take a pee break.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead. All right, guys, we're back. Much needed pee break. Listen, this guy's been sober 40 years.
Right.
There was a pee break. So, yeah, so we're talking about, like, the magic of AA and of recovery. And just, mm-hmm. you know, the non-transactional. Well, I think it is, in some ways, for me, it was taught to me. Like, it is a transaction, but it's like a pay-it-forward transaction. Like, my first sponsor would tell me, I'm helping you just so you can help somebody else. That's the main reason why I'm helping you, because we need you to help somebody else. I don't need anything back from you. And, like, you know what I'm saying? So it was just like, I used to thank him, like, you know, thank you so much, man. You're helping me. He's like, don't thank me. You know, he says, I'm helping you so you can help somebody else. That is the main focus, you know, that because there's no governing body. You know, this is not like grade school where somebody's like, you know, there's no exams. We all got to help each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's like the most important thing where you can see as the world has changed. Even like what you're talking about from Vietnam, but just even now where like people are really missing that selflessness that we've been fortunate enough to live with for so long. For me, 20, for you, 40. But like, I know how good humanity can be. Like, it's not like a theory for me. And I see miracles on a weekly basis.
Absolutely.
Where like some people, they don't have that in their life. And that's like a big effect on me, that I see these miracles, these new guys calling, the new guy wanting to pay you back for the friggin' hot dog. You know, I always joke that like, you know, we laugh when we clap when you get your kids back. It's the only place on earth, AA, where we clap when somebody gets their kids back, you know? And it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, yeah. The, yeah, I mean, that's, like I say, that's how I've been treated. I've never been pushed around. Talking about your sponsor, I think that was, you know, one of the things, asking somebody to be my sponsor, somebody asking my first sponsor to be my sponsor.
What was that like?
I think it was one of the most important things I've ever done in my life. Because there's, I haven't said this in a long time, but I mean, if you asked a man for help, you were, you know, all you could get from a guy would be bullshit, and you know, sports talk and stuff like that, you know. And then I was aware that asking somebody to be your sponsor was you were asking them to help you, you know. And I've never forgotten what he said. I called him up. I liked the way he talked. I liked the way he looked. I liked him in the meetings, and I got his phone number. And about 6 weeks later, I called him, and I said, "Oh, I'm sorry it took me so long to call you." And he said, no, you're right on time." And that's how I've been treated all the time I've been in AA. No, you're right on time. Yeah.
What does it feel like for you to be able to give that to somebody? All the love that you received. What is it like for you to be able to give that to people?
It's an extraordinary blessing. Extraordinary blessing. You know, I've seen.
Just to tell somebody, listen, it's okay. You're right on time. You're right. In the right place. Right. All of these very like hokey things that you're talking about, to be able to give somebody that exhale breath.
Right. I've seen people, I've seen people get married and have children who, and I've seen the children grow up, you know, and all in AA, you know. I've seen, that's one of the things I've realized is, we can change generations here. I've seen people who've come from, you know, terrible situations, become loving parents, and, you don't have to relive the past. You can. You know, it's funny, sometimes we go to an AA meeting and you think, rehashing the same story over and over again. But that's not true. You come until you start having your own story. And then if I had to describe in one word what describes AA, I'd say listen. We listen. We listen to each other. We listen to the guy who has one day. We listen to the guy. I was in a meeting, and I was listened to. This guy Eddie. You have no idea who's going to save your life in AA. This guy, Eddie, he was a longshoreman. And he would listen to me. I'd be going on. This was early on in my time in AA. I'd be going on telling him all sorts of stuff. The meetings in those days ended, almost all the meetings were at 8:30 at night. So the meeting ended at 9:30. It'd be 10 o'clock at night, and Eddie would be getting up at 5 in the morning to go work on the docks, and he would sit and listen to me. And I've never forgotten what he, sometimes when I'm going on in my own head, it still goes on. I'm making circles around my head now. And he'd say, Joe, how important is this? How important is this? He was real Brooklyn. And I was so consumed with myself, I thought, Eddie just doesn't understand, you know? And it was only as I got sober that I realized, like, my God, this guy loved me. This guy loved me. He was going to get up, you know, and he sat and listened to me, you know, because he was absolutely devoted to AA. He was devoted to AA.
That's incredible. And I think that's the whole key.
Right.
Yeah. Looking back, that you don't realize what somebody's doing for you. And then as you evolved, you can look back and be like, holy shit, this guy loved me.
The other thing, you're bringing me back to the past, the other thing I remember is this guy, Steve the Fisherman.
Oh, him I've heard of.
Oh, he was something.
He was the guy, he used to make the whales.
Right, exactly. And one day we're talking, and I'm talking about something was going on at home. And I've never forgotten what he said, you know, when your spouse or your mate or your friend is not an alcoholic. And he said, you got to understand that they don't understand. And, you know, I'm the sober one. I got to understand that they don't understand. They don't understand.
Yeah.
They didn't sit in a chair in the middle of the night drinking like a pig. They don't understand that.
People, against their will.
Against their will. You know. That's the other thing that I believe for myself, that I could not get sober unless I took responsibility for every single drink I took. And it's nobody's fault.
Oh, yeah.
It's nobody's fault. You know, and I've seen people who stayed sober and they're still pissed off at their mothers. They're like 70 years old and they're pissed off at their parents. It's like,
yeah.
Maybe they're sober, but I don't want that, you know.
I don't want that either.
No.
I'm not. I'm grateful that after I got sober, my parents, they still spoke to me the way I treated them and everybody else. Right. Yeah. We'll wrap up on this, but the longer you stick around, the more your story changes. Not so much the actions that I took, but my perception of what was going on really changes. So it's like when I first came around, sure, everything sounded funny, and they were doing it was this, them, and them. And then the more I got closer to God, and the more I did the work, and the more I faced myself, I'm like, all right, maybe it was 3% them and 97% me. You know? It's like, yeah. They were doing the best they could, and my response to that led me to where we are right now.
Right, right.
Yeah. You got to be... Somebody said this. I don't know where I was. Said, even victims have to be responsible for their actions.
Right.
It's heavy.
Very heavy.
But it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
All right, guys. We're going to wrap it up. Joe, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Dude, you did an hour. You did fantastic. You know? Don't forget, everybody, like and subscribe on all podcast platforms. The Sober Experience. Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google, everywhere. And, listen, I could stay talking with you for another 3 hours. I always enjoy your insight and the simplicity of your spirituality. It's always impressive. So, all right, we're going to sign off. All right, guys, have a great day.